Hello, and welcome to the Learning College. My name is Alex Linder, and you can find this and everything we record at vnnforum.com. Today we're going to do chapters 13 and 14 from Hector Humanroe, or Saki as he's better known, his novel, The Unbearable Bassington, chapter 13 and 14. Let's begin. This will be our penultimate session. Last time we'll do 15, 16, and 17 as one unit to close it. The Unbearable Bassington, chapter 13. Comus found his way to a seat in the stalls of the Straw Exchange Theater and turned to watch the stream of distinguished and distinguishable people who made their appearance, as a matter of course, at a first night at the height of the season. Pit and gallery were already packed with a throng, tense, expectant, and alert, that waited for the rise of the curtain with the eager patience of a terrier watching a dilatory human prepare for outdoor exercises. Stalls and boxes filled slowly and hesitatingly with a crowd whose component units seemed for the most part to recognize the probability that they were quite as interesting as any play they were likely to see. Those who bore no particular face value themselves derived a certain amount of social dignity from the near neighborhood of obvious notabilities. If one could not obtain recognition oneself, there was some vague pleasure in being able to recognize notoriety at intimately close quarters. Who is that woman with the auburn hair and a rather effective belligerent gleam in her eyes? Asked a man sitting just behind Comus. She looks as if she might have created the world in 6 days and destroyed it on the seventh. I forget her name, said his neighbor. She writes. She is the author of that book, The Woman Who Wished It Was Wednesday, you know. It used to be the convention that women writers should be plain and dowdy. Now we have gone to the other extreme and build them on extravagantly decorative lines. A buzz of recognition came from the front rows of the pit, together with a craning of necks on the part of those in less favored seats. It heralded the arrival of Sherard Blaw, the dramatist who had discovered himself and who had given so ungrudgingly of his discovery to the world. Again, he's making fun of George Bernard Shaw, whom for some reason he detests. Lady Caroline, who was already directing little conversational onslaughts from her box, gazed gently for a moment at the new arrival, and then turned to the silver-haired archdeacon sitting beside her. They say the poor man is haunted by the fear that he will die during a general election, and that his obituary notices will be seriously curtailed by the space taken up by the election results. The curse of our party system, from his point of view, is that it takes up so much room in the press. The archdeacon smiled indulgently. As a man, he was so exquisitely worldly that he fully merited the name of the heavenly worldling bestowed on him by an admiring duchess, and withal his texture was shot with a pattern of such genuine saintliness that one felt that, whoever else might hold the keys of paradise, he at least possessed a private latchkey to that abode. Is it not significant of the altered grouping of things, he observed, that the church, as represented by me, sympathizes with the message of Sherard Blaw, while neither the man nor his message find acceptance with unbelievers like you, Lady Caroline? He meant they're into a vague sort of socialism. Lady Caroline blinked her eyes. My dear Archdeacon, she said, no one can be an unbeliever nowadays. The Christian apologists have left one nothing to disbelieve. The archdeacon rose with a delighted chuckle. I must go tell that to De La Poulette, he said, indicating a clerical figure sitting in the third row of the stalls. He spends his life explaining from his pulpit that the glory of Christianity consists in the fact that, though it is not true, it has been found necessary to invent it. The door of the box opened and Courtney Ugel entered, bringing with him a subtle suggestion of chaminade and atmosphere of political tension. The government had fallen out of the good graces of a section of its supporters, and those who were not in the know were busy predicting a serious crisis over a forthcoming division in the committee stage of an important bill. This was Saturday night, and unless some successful cajolery were effected between now and Monday afternoon, ministers would be, seemingly, in danger of defeat. "Ah, here is Ugel," said the Archdeacon. "He will be able to tell us what is going to happen in the next 48 hours. I hear the Prime Minister says it is a matter of conscience, and they will stand or fall by it." His hopes and sympathies were notoriously on the ministerial side. Ugel greeted Lady Caroline and subsided gracefully into a chair well in front of the box. A buzz of recognition rippled slowly across the house. "For the government to fall in a matter of conscience," he said, "would be like a man cutting himself with a safety razor." Lady Caroline purred a gentle approval. "I'm afraid it's true, Archdeacon," she said. "No one can effectively defend a government when it's been in office several years. The Archdeacon took refuge in light skirmishing. I believe Lady Caroline sees the makings of a great socialist statement in you, Ugel," he said. "Great socialist statesmen aren't made, they're stillborn," replied Ugel. "What is the play about tonight?" asked a pale young woman who had taken no part in the talk. "I don't know," said Lady Caroline, "but I hope it's dull. If there is any brilliant conversation in it, I shall burst into tears." In the front row of the upper circle, a woman with a restless, starling voice was discussing the work of a temporarily fashionable composer, chiefly in relation to her own emotions, which she seemed to think might prove generally interesting to those around her. "Whenever I hear his music, I feel that I want to go up into a mountain and pray. Can you understand that feeling?" The girl to whom she was unburdening herself shook her head. "You see, I've heard his music chiefly in Switzerland, and we were up among the mountains all the time, so it wouldn't have made any difference." "In that case," said the woman, who seemed to have emergency emotions to suit all geographical conditions, "I should have wanted to be in a great silent plain along the side of a rushing river." "What I think is so splendid about his music," commenced another starling voice on the farther side of the girl, "like sheep that feed greedily before the coming of a storm, the starling voices seemed impelled to extra effort by the knowledge of 4 imminent intervals of acting, during which they would be hushed in a constrained silence." In the back row of the dress circle, a latecomer, after a cursory glance at the program, had settled down into a comfortable narrative which was evidently the resumed thread of an unfinished taxi drive monologue. "We all said, 'It can't be Captain Parmenter, because he's always been sweet on Joan.' And then Emily said..." The curtain went up, and Emily's contribution to the discussion had to be held over until the entr'acte, the between act, or intermission. The play promised to be a success. The author, avoiding the pitfall of brilliancy, had aimed at being interesting, and as far as possible, bearing in mind that his play was a comedy, he had striven to be amusing. Above all, he had remembered that in the laws of stage proportions, it is permissible and generally desirable that the part should be greater than the whole. Hence, he had been careful to give the leading lady such a clear and commanding lead over the other characters of the play that it was impossible for any of them ever to get on level terms with her. The action of the piece was now and then delayed thereby, but the duration of its run would be materially prolonged. The curtain came down in the first act amid an encouraging installment of applause, and the audience turned its back on the stage and began to take a renewed interest in itself. The authoress of The Woman Who Wished It Was Wednesday had swept, like a convalescent whirlwind, subdued but potentially tempestuous, into Lady Caroline's box. "I've just trodden with all my weight on the foot of an eminent publisher as I was leaving my seat," she cried with a peal of delighted laughter. "He was such a dear about it. I said I hoped I hadn't hurt him, and he said, 'I suppose you think who drives hard bargains should himself be hard.' Wasn't it pet lamb of him?" "I've never trodden on a pet lamb," said Lady Caroline, "so I've no idea what its behavior would be under the circumstances." "Tell me," said the authoress, coming to the front of the box, the better to survey the house, and perhaps also with a charitable desire to make things easy for those who might pardonably wish to survey her. "Tell me, please, where is the girl sitting whom Courtney Ugel is engaged to?" Elaine was pointed out to her, sitting in the fourth row of the stalls on the opposite side of the house to where Comus had his seat. Once during the interval, she had returned to him to give him a friendly nod of recognition as he stood in one of the side gangways but he was absorbed in the moment in looking at himself in the glass panel. The grave brown eyes and the mocking green-gray ones had looked their last into each other's depths. For Comus, this first night performance, with its brilliant gathering of spectators, its groups and coteries of lively talkers, even its counterfoil of dull chatterers, its pervading atmosphere of stage and social movement, and its intruding undercurrent of political flutter, all this composed a tragedy in which he was the chief character. It was the life he knew and loved and basked in, and it was the life he was leaving. It would go on reproducing itself again and again, with its stage interest and social interest and intruding outside interests, with the same lively chattering crowd, the people who had done things being pointed out by people who recognized them to people who didn't. It would all go on with unflagging animation and sparkle and enjoyment, and for him, it would have stopped utterly. He would be in some unheard-of sun-blistered wilderness, where natives and pariah dogs and raucous-throated crows fringed round mockingly on one's loneliness, where one rode for sweltering miles for the chance of meeting a collector or police officer, with whom, most likely on closer acquaintance, one had hardly two ideas in common, where female society was represented at long intervals by some climate-withered woman missionary or official's wife, where food and sickness and veterinary lore became at last the three outstanding subjects on which the mind settled, or rather sank. That was the life he foresaw and dreaded, and that was the life he was going to. For a boy who went out from the dullness of some country rectory, from a neighborhood where a flower show and a cricket match formed the social landmarks of the year, the feeling of exile might not be very crushing, might indeed be lost in the sense of change and adventure. But Comus had lived too thoroughly in the center of things to regard life in a backwater as anything else than stagnation. And stagnation, while one is young, he justly regarded as an offense against nature and reason. In keeping with the perverted mockery that sends decrepit invalids touring painfully about the world and shuts up panthers up in narrow cages. He was being put aside as a wine is put aside, but to deteriorate instead of gaining in the process, to lose the best time of his youth and health and good looks in a world where youth and health and good looks count for much, and where time never returns lost possessions. And thus, as the curtain swept down on the close of each act, Comus felt a sense of depression and deprivation sweep down on himself. Bitterly, he watched his last evening of social gaiety slipping away to its end. In less than an hour, it would be over. In a few months' time, it would be an unreal memory. In the third interval, as he gazed round at the chattering house, someone touched him on the arm. It was Lady Viola Crute. "I suppose in a week's time you'll be on the high seas," she said. "I'm coming to your farewell dinner, you know. Your mother has just asked me. I'm not going to talk the usual rot to you about how much you will like it and so on. I sometimes think that one of the advantages of hell will be that no one will have the impertinence to point out that you're really better off than you would be anywhere else. What do you think of the play?" Of course, one can foresee the end. She will come to her husband with the announcement that they're long-for child is going to be born, and that will smooth over everything. So conveniently effective to wind up a comedy with the commencement of someone else's tragedy. And everyone will go away saying, "I'm glad it had a happy ending." Lady Viola moved back to her seat with her pleasant smile on her lips and the look of infinite weariness in her eyes. The interval, the last interval, was drawing to a close, and the house began to turn with fidgety attention towards the stage for the unfolding of the final phase of the play. Francesca sat in Serena Golackley's box, listening to Colonel Springfield's story of what happened to a pigeon cote in his compound at Poona. Everyone who knew the Colonel had to listen to that story a good many times, but Lady Caroline had mitigated the boredom of the infliction, and in fact invested it with a certain sporting interest, by offering a prize to the person who heard it oftenest in the course of the season, the competitors being under an honorable understanding not to lead up to the subject. Ada Spelvexit and a boy in the Foreign Office were at present at the top of the list with five recitals each to their score, but the former was suspected of doubtful adherence to the rules and spirit of the competition. And there, dear lady, concluded the colonel, were the 11 dead pigeons. What had become of the bandicoot, no one ever knew. Francesca thanked him for his story and complacently inscribed the figure 4 on the margin of her theater program. Almost at the same moment, she heard George St. Michael's voice pattering out a breathless piece of intelligence for the edification of Serena Golackley and anyone else who might care to listen. Francesca galvanized into sudden attention. Emmeline Chetroff to a fellow in the Indian Forest Department. He's got nothing but his pay, and they can't be married for 4 or 5 years, an absurdly long engagement. Don't you think so? All very well to wait 7 years for a wife in patriarchal times when you probably had others to go on with and you lived long enough to celebrate your own tercentenary. But under modern conditions, it seems a foolish arrangement. St. Michael spoke with almost a sense of grievance. A marriage project that tied up the small, pleasant nuptial gossip items about bridesmaids and honeymoon and recalcitrant aunts and so forth for an indefinite number of years seemed scarcely decent in his eyes, and there was little satisfaction or importance to be derived from early and special knowledge of an event which loomed as far distant as a presidential election or a change of viceroy. But to Francesca, who had listened with startled apprehension at the mention of Emmeline Chetroff's name, the news came in a flood of relief and thankfulness. Short of entering a nunnery and taking celibate vows, Emmeline could hardly have behaved more conveniently than in tying herself up to a lover whose circumstances made it necessary to relegate marriage to the distant future. For 4 or 5 years, Francesca was assured of undisturbed possession of the house at Blue Street, and after that period, who knew what might happen? The engagement might stretch on indefinitely. It might even come to nothing under the weight of its accumulated years, as sometimes happened with these protracted affairs. Emmeline might lose her fancy for her absentee lover and might never replace him with another. A golden possibility of perpetual tenancy of her present home began to float once more through Francesca's mind. As long as Emmeline had been unbespoken in the marriage market, there had always been the haunting likelihood of seeing the dreaded announcement, "A marriage has been arranged and will shortly take place," in connection with her name. So it looks like a reprieve for Francesca. And now a marriage had been arranged and would not shortly take place, might indeed never take place. St. Michael's information was likely to be correct in this instance. He would never have invented a piece of matrimonial intelligence which gave such little scope for supplementary detail of the kind he so loved to supply. As Francesca turned to watch the fourth act of the play, her mind was singing a paean of thankfulness and exultation. It was as though some artificer sent by the gods had reinforced with a substantial cord the horsehair thread that held up the sword of Damocles over her head. Her love for her home, for her treasured household possessions, and her pleasant social life was able to expand once more in present security and feed on future hope. She was still young enough to count 4 or 5 years as a long time, and tonight she was optimistic enough to prophesy smooth things of the future that lay beyond that span. Of the fourth act, with its carefully held back but obviously imminent reconciliation between the leading characters, she took in little, except that she vaguely understood it to have a happy ending. As the lights went up, she looked round on the dispersing audience with a feeling of friendliness uppermost in her mind. Even the sight of Elaine Defry and Courtenay Ugel leaving the theater together did not inspire her with a tenth part of the annoyance that their entrance had caused. Serena's invitation to go on to the Savoy for supper fitted in exactly with her mood of exhilaration. It would be a fit and appropriate wind-up to an auspicious evening. The cold chicken and modest brand of Chablis waiting for her at home should give way to a banquet of more festive nature. In the crush of the vestibule, friends and enemies, personal and political, were jostled and locked together in the general effort to rejoin temporarily estranged garments and secure the attendance of elusive vehicles. Lady Caroline found herself at close quarters with the estimable Henry Greech and experienced some of the joy which comes to the homeward wending sportsman when a chance shot presents itself on which he may expand his remaining cartridges. "So the government is going to climb down after all," she said, with a provocative assumption of private information on the subject. "I assure you the government will do nothing of the kind," replied the Member of Parliament with befitting dignity. The Prime Minister told me last night that under no circumstances. My dear Mr. Greech, said Lady Caroline, we all know that Prime Ministers are wedded to the truth, but like other wedded couples, they sometimes live apart. For her, at any rate, the comedy had a happy ending. Comus made his way slowly and lingeringly from the stalls, so slowly that the lights were already being turned down and great shroud-like dust cloths were being swathed over the ornamental gilt work. The laughing, chattering, yawning throng had filtered out of the vestibule and was melting away in final groups from the steps of the theater. An impatient attendant gave him his coat and locked up the cloakroom. Comus stepped out under the portico. He looked at the posters announcing the play, and in anticipation, he could see other posters announcing its 200th performance. 200 performances, by that time the Straw Exchange Theater, would be to him something so remote and unreal that it would hardly seem to exist or to have ever existed except in his fancy. And to the laughing, chattering throng that would pass in under that portico to the 200th performance, he would be, to those that had known him, something equally remote and non-existent. The good-looking Bassington boy, oh, dead or rubber-growing or sheep-farming or something of that sort. Ends chapter 13. Chapter 14. The farewell dinner which Francesca had hurriedly organized in honor of her son's departure threatened from the outset to be a doubtfully successful function. In the first place, as he observed privately, there was very little of Comus and a good deal of farewell in it. His own particular friends were unrepresented. Courtney Ugel was out of the question, and though Francesca would have stretched a point and welcomed some of his other male associates of whom she scarcely approved, he himself had been opposed to including any of them in the invitations. On the other hand, as Henry Greech had provided Comus with this job and that he was going out to and was, moreover, finding part of the money for the necessary outfit, Francesca had felt it her duty to ask him and his wife to the dinner. The obtuseness that seems to cling to some people like a garment throughout their life had caused Mr. Greech to accept the invitation. When Comus heard of the circumstance, he laughed long and boisterously. His spirits, Francesca noted, seemed to be rising as fast as the hour for departure drew near. The other guests included Serena Golackley and Lady Viula, the latter having been asked on the inspiration of the moment at the theatrical first night. In the height of the season, it was not easy to get together a goodly selection of guests at short notice, and Francesca had gladly fallen in with Serena's suggestion of bringing with her Stephen Thorell, who was alleged, in loose feminine phrasing, to know all about tropical Africa. His travels and experiences in those regions probably did not cover much ground or stretch over any great length of time, but he was one of those individuals who can describe a continent on the strength of a few days' stay in a coast town as intimately and dogmatically as a paleontologist. Ha! Now this is wonderful. As intimately and dogmatically as a paleontologist will reconstruct an extinct mammal from the evidence of a stray shin bone. Now that is great. He had the loud, penetrating voice and the prominent, penetrating eyes of a man who can do no listening in the ordinary way and whose eyes have to perform the function of listening for him. His vanity did not necessarily make him unbearable unless one had to spend much time in his society, and his need for a wide field of audience and admiration was mercifully calculated to spread his operations over a considerable human area. Moreover, his craving for attentive listeners forced him to interest himself in a wonderful variety of subjects on which he was able to discourse fluently and with a certain semblance of special knowledge. Politics he avoided. The ground was too well known, and there was a definite no to every definite yes that could be put forward. Moreover, argument was not congenial to his disposition, which preferred an unchallenged flow of dissertation modified by occasional helpful questions, which formed the starting points for new offshoots of word spinning. The promotion of cottage industries, the prevention of juvenile street trading, the extension of the Borstal prison system, the furtherance of vague, talkative religious movements, of the fostering of interracial ententes, all found in him a tireless exponent, a fluent and entertaining, though perhaps not very convincing, advocate. With the real motive power behind those various causes, he was not very closely identified. To the spade workers who carried on the actual labors of each particular movement, he bore the relation of a trowel worker, delving superficially on the surface, but able to devote a proportionally far greater amount of time to the advertisement of his progress and achievements. Such was Stephen Thorell, a governess in the nursery of Chelsea-bred religions, a skilled window dresser in the emporium of his own personality, and needless to say, evanescently popular amid a wide but shifting circle of acquaintances. He improved on the record of a socially much-traveled individual whose experience had become classical and went to most of the best houses twice. His inclusion as a guest at this particular dinner party was not a very happy inspiration. He was inclined to patronize Comus, as well as the African continent, and on even slighter acquaintance. With the exception of Henry Greech, whose feelings towards his nephew had been soured by many years of overt antagonism, there was an uncomfortable feeling among those present that the topic of the black sheep export trade, as Comus would have himself expressed it, the black sheep export trade, was being given undue prominence in what should have been a festive farewell banquet. And Comus, in whose honor the feast was given, did not contribute much towards its success. Though his spirit seemed strung up to a high pitch, his merriment was more the merriment of a cynical and amused onlooker than of one who responds to the gaiety of his companions. Sometimes he laughed quietly to himself at some chance remark of a scarcely myth-provoking nature, and Lady Viula, watching him narrowly, came to the conclusion that an element of fear was blended with his seemingly buoyant spirits. Once or twice he caught her eye across the table, and a certain sympathy seemed to grow up between them, as though they were both consciously watching some lugubrious comedy that was being played out before them. Lugubrious, ridiculously sorrowful or mournful. An untoward little incident had marked the commencement of the meal. A small still-life picture that hung over the sideboard had snapped its cord and slid down with an alarming clatter onto the crowded board beneath it. The picture itself was scarcely damaged, but its fall had been accompanied by a tinkle of broken glass, and it was found that a liqueur glass, one out of a set of seven that would be impossible to match, had been shivered into fragments. Francesca's almost motherly love for her possessions made her peculiarly sensible to a feeling of annoyance and depression at the accident, but she turned politely to listen to Mrs. Greech's account of a misfortune in which four soup plates were involved. Mrs. Henry was not a brilliant conversationalist, and her flank was speedily turned by Stephen Thorell, who recounted a slum experience in which two entire families did all their feeding out of one damaged soup plate. The gratitude of those poor creatures when I presented them with a set of table crockery apiece, the tears in their eyes and in their voices when they thanked me would be impossible to describe. "Thank you all the same for describing it," said Comus. The listening eyes went swiftly round the table to gather evidence as to how this rather disconcerting remark had been received, but Thorell's voice continued uninterruptedly to retail stories of East End gratitude, never failing to mention the particular deeds of disinterested charity on his part which evoked and justified the gratitude. There's nothing more boring than continually telling stories of which you are the hero, is what he seems to be saying, and I would agree with that, but that's why most people do things. Mrs. Greech had to suppress the interesting sequel to her broken crockery narrative, to wit, how she subsequently matched the shattered soup plates at Harrod's. Like an imported plant species that sometimes flourishes exceedingly and makes itself at home to the dwarfing and overshadowing of all native species, Thorell dominated the dinner party and thrust its original purport somewhat into the background. Excuse me. Serena began to look helplessly apologetic. It was altogether a relief when the filling of champagne glasses gave Francesca an excuse for bringing matters back to their intended footing. "We must all drink a health," she said. "Comus, my own dear boy, a safe and happy voyage to you. Much prosperity in the life you are going out to, and in due time a safe and happy return." Her hand gave an involuntary jerk in the act of raising the glass, and the wine went streaming across the tablecloth in a froth of yellow bubbles. It certainly was not turning out a comfortable or auspicious dinner party. "My dear mother," said Comus, "you must have been drinking healths all the afternoon to make your hand so unsteady." He laughed gaily and with apparent carelessness, but again Lady Viola caught the frightened note in his laughter. Mrs. Henry, with practical sympathy, was telling Francesca two good ways for getting wine stains out of tablecloths. The smaller economies of life were an unnecessary branch of learning for Mrs. Greech, but she studied them as carefully and conscientiously as a stay-at-home, plain-dwelling English child commits to memory the measurements and altitudes of the world's principal peaks. Some women of her temperament and mentality know by heart the favorite colors, flowers, and hymn tunes of all the members of the royal family. Mrs. Greech would possibly have failed in an examination of that nature, but she knew what to do with carrots that had been overlong in storage. Francesca did not renew her speech-making. A chill seemed to have fallen over all efforts at festivity, and she contented herself with refilling her glass and simply drinking to her boy's good health. The others followed her example, and Comus drained his glass with a brief, "Thank you all very much." The sense of constraint which hung over the company was not, however, marked by any uncomfortable pause in the conversation. Henry Greech was a fluent thinker, of the kind that preferred to do their thinking aloud. The silence that descended on him as a mantle in the House of Commons was an official livery of which he divested himself as thoroughly as possible in private life. He did not propose to sit through dinner as a mere listener to Mr. Thorle's personal narrative of philanthropic movements and experiences, and took the first opportunity of launching himself into a flow of satirical observations on current political affairs. Lady Viola was inured to this sort of thing in her own home circle, and sat listening with the stoical indifference with which an Eskimo might accept the occurrence of one snowstorm the more in the course of an Arctic winter. Serena Glowlackley felt a certain relief at the fact that her imported guest was not, after all, monopolizing the conversation. But the latter was too determined a personality to allow himself to be thrust for many minutes by the talkative MP Henry Greech, Henry Greech paused for an instant to chuckle at one of his own shafts of satire, and immediately Thorle's penetrating voice swept across the table. "Oh, you politicians," he exclaimed with pleasant superiority, "you are always fighting about how things should be done, and the consequences you are never able to do anything. Do you like me to tell you what a Unitarian horse dealer said to me at Brindisi about politicians?" A Unitarian horse dealer at Brindisi had all the allurement of the unexpected. Henry Greech's witticisms at the expense of the front opposition bench were destined to remain as unfinished as his wife's history of the broken soup plates. Thorle was prime with ample succession of stories and themes, chiefly concerning poverty, thriftlessness, reclamation, reform characters, and so forth, which carried him in an almost uninterrupted sequence through the remainder of the dinner. "What I want to do is make people think," he said, turning his prominent eyes onto his hostesses. "It's so hard to make people think." "At any rate, you give them the opportunity," said Comus cryptically. As the ladies rose to leave the table, Comus crossed over to pick up one of Lady Viola's gloves that had fallen to the floor. "I did not know you kept a dog," said Lady Viola. "I could have sworn I saw you follow one across the hall this evening," she said. "A small black dog, something like a Schipperke." "Or a Schipperke," she asked Comus in a low voice. I don't know what that is. I've never come across that kind of dog before, a Schipperke. Yes, that was it, he said. I saw it myself tonight. It ran from behind my chair just as I was sitting down. Don't say anything about it to the others. It would frighten my mother. Have you ever seen it before? Lady Viola asked quickly. Once, when I was 6 years old, it followed my father downstairs. Lady Viola said nothing. She knew that Comus had lost his father at the age of 6, so this dog symbolizes his death, or at least his social death. In the drawing room, Serena made nervous excuses for her talkative friend. Really a rather interesting man, you know, and up to the eyes in all sorts of movements. Just the sort of person to turn loose at a drawing room meeting or sounding board in a harmonium and a titled woman of some sort in the chair, and he'll be perfectly happy. I must say, I hadn't realized how overpowering he might be at a small dinner party. I should say he was a very good man, said Mrs. Creech. She had forgiven the mutilation of her soup plate story. The party broke up early, as most of the guests had other engagements to keep. With a belated recognition of the farewell nature of the occasion, they made pleasant little goodbye remarks to Comus, with the usual predictions of prosperity and anticipations of an ultimate auspicious return. Even Henry Greech sank his personal dislike of the boy for a moment and made a hearty jocular allusions to a homecoming which, in the elder man's eyes, seemed possibly pleasantly remote. Lady Viola alone made no reference to the future. She simply said, "Goodbye, Comus." But her voice was the kindest of all, and he responded with a look of gratitude. The weariness in her eyes was more marked than ever as she lay back against the cushions of her carriage. "What a tragedy life is," she said aloud to herself. Is that the author's view, you think? Serena and Stephen Thorle were the last to leave, and Francesca stood alone for a moment at the head of the stairway, watching Comus laughing and chatting as he escorted the departing guest to the door. The ice wall was melting under the influence of coming separation, and never had he looked more adorably handsome in her eyes. Never had his merry laugh and mischief-loving gaiety seemed more infectious than on this night of his farewell banquet. She was glad enough that he was going away from a life of idleness and extravagance and temptation, but she began to suspect that she would miss, for a little while at any rate, the high-spirited boy who could be so attractive in his better moods. Her impulse, after the guests had gone, was to call him to her and hold him once more in her arms and repeat her wishes for his happiness and good luck in the land he was going to, and her promise of his welcome back, some not too distant day, to the land he was leaving. She wanted to forget, and to make him forget, the months of irritable jangling and sharp discussions, the months of cold aloofness and indifference, and remember only that he was her own dear Comus, as in the days of yore, before he had grown from an unmanageable pickle into a weariful problem. A weariful problem. That's a word you don't see. Weariful. But she feared lest she should break down, and she did not wish to cloud his lighthearted gaiety on the very eve of his departure. She watched him for a moment as he stood in the hall, settling his tie before a mirror, and then went quietly back to her drawing room. It had not been a very successful dinner party, and the general effect it had left on her was one of depression. Comus, with a lively musical comedy air on his lips and a look of wretchedness in his eyes, went out to visit the haunts that he was leaving so soon. So what sounds like one last night in the town for Comus. And that would be the end of chapter 14, leaving us one more segment remaining. So I've been Alex Linder reading to you out of Saki and The Unbearable Bassington, a short novel he wrote. Thanks for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon.